We'll call this message American Exceptionalism and the Bible. American Exceptionalism and the Bible. I want to focus for a moment on the recent two elections that there have been. This summer, the British had a referendum called the Brexit vote. And in this country, of course, you could hardly fail to know that we had a very heated election. And they had something in common, these two votes. The pundits, the political class, those in power, those that are power brokers, the establishment, all figured that the Brits would stay in the EU and that Mrs. Clinton would be president of the United States. Well, neither one of those things came to pass because with the usual plottings and plannings, they left out the people that paid the taxes. Those in flyover land in both countries were ignored. And there was a palpable fear among the body politic that their nations were slipping away, that national interests were not the concern of those leading them, but they were looking in more of a global sense. So, you know, this, what happened wasn't really predicted. In this country, we had four states that they called the Brexit states. That would be Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. States that, in some cases, overwhelmingly and continuously have voted Democrat. And yet there were crossover votes. So that, in terms of electoral votes, Mr. Trump won a landslide election in the Electoral College. Well, he made American exceptionalism a big part of his campaign. It was the theme, Make America Great Again. What does that mean? What does that mean? For one thing, it says that America was great at one time and maybe has slipped. Maybe there are certain things that now we're leading from behind. We're no longer as respected, perhaps. The economy hasn't been so good. So people are worried. They're worried that they might lose their country. And that had a lot to do with the vote. And of course, God sets up kings and knocks down one and sets up another. So the will of God may be in play. I think we can say that definitely. But will a President Trump be able to correct everything that we should correct? Well, you can say, well, the economy could be improved. Maybe our foreign policy can be better. Maybe other domestic policy can be improved. And maybe he'll do all of that. But God isn't so concerned about GDP, is he? He's more concerned about the state of righteousness in a country. And I'm not certain anyone can do anything about that right now. Well, American exceptionalism has even become a debating point now, but there was a time when that wasn't the case. People understood what that meant, what that referred to, why America was great. Rush Limbaugh, who I listen to on occasion when I get the chance to, the other day he was referring to America this way. He said, America is a God-blessed miracle. Now, there's a truth, a very great truth there. And then Michael Medved, for years, another talk host, has been signing off his program by saying that America is the greatest nation on God's green earth. And yet the current president, who supported Mrs. Clinton in the race, someone asked him about American exceptionalism, and here was his retort. All nations think they're special, and they want special favors. But that's not what American exceptionalism is, brethren. So we'll look at that today, and then we'll look at the biblical roots behind it. We're going to be looking at history, but we're going to look at history through the prism of the Bible. So also we're considering the fact that we're in the Thanksgiving season now, and this is a time when we should consider our blessings and from whence they've come, to realize that with these blessings, that God has certain responsibilities that we are supposed to fulfill. And he has given us blessings for a purpose. And people would say, well, it's not fair that America and Britain should have as much as they have had over the past two centuries. Is God being fair to other people? Does God love everybody equally, or is he choosing favorites? What's the reason why we've been favored the way we've been favored? Well, we need to explore that today. We need to see what God's expectations have been in giving these blessings. And keeping in mind that principle of the Bible, that to whom much is given, much is expected and required. Well, brethren, we are at a crossroads right now. There are those that would go full throttle ahead with all that we've seen and we would call immoral, but they are cheering it on. And then there are others that would like to return to something more respectable, when America had a respected position in the world, and that we genuinely had some leadership going on here in this country that could benefit the entire world, or at least the Western world. But so we'll look at that today. America is in danger. And if we choose the wrong way, as we will see in the scriptures, there will be a time of Jacob's trouble to come. So that's where we are. We're at a crossroads right now. Will we turn around or not? We'll be looking at some of that today. Well, first of all, spend a little time on what is American exceptionalism. What is meant by that? You know, there are two senses of the word. The first, that America's history and America's founding is unique. It's been one of a kind. When you look at all of the things that influenced the founding of this country, it is just profoundly unique. And then the other aspect of it is that our founding is better than the foundings of any other nation, because the documents were based in large part on the Holy Scriptures. And that's, again, one of a kind. That makes our Constitution, I'm not saying that it's completely inspired, but there are biblical principles and laws and truths within our Constitution and within the Declaration of Independence. So we'll look at some of these things today here. It is a God-blessed miracle, as we'll see. First of all, let's think about America. First of all, it was a British colony. It was a British colony, and you look at Britain. There used to be something called the Divine Right of Kings, and that may have had a lot to do with the promises God made to David, that David would never lack a descendant over at least parts of Israel. And we know also, from many biblical proofs, and has been a teaching in the church for so many years, that the one sitting on the throne of Britain is a descendant of David. Well, about 1215, something called the Magna Carta comes along, and grudgingly, King John gives up some of his power, a little bit of his power, which benefited the nobles, and it's at some level benefited everybody in Britain. But anciently, you had kings and you had serfs and a handful of nobles, and that's pretty much the way the world has worked. So for America to be what America was, it's just amazing to think about it here. So then you had about 1,000 years of English common law, which has worked its way into most of our legal codes around the country. And we've benefited from that as well. So why would we leave the sphere of England? I think we know that God made specific promises to the house of Joseph, both Ephraim and Manasseh, and we'll explore what that is as well. We have a new booklet on the subject, and maybe you've all read the church's new booklet. It's a very fine one, and if you have, then what we're covering today is just a little bit of reinforcement of what you've already been looking at. But I think it would be useful to continue going down this path here. But we ask the question then, why leave? I mean, is there any precedent for that? And the answer is yes. Remember the biblical precedent. Solomon died, great king. His son Rehoboam took over the throne. And Jeroboam and representatives of the tribes of Israel came to him and said, you know, your father was put so many burdens on us. We want some breaks. We need some tax breaks. And he, instead of listening to the old advisors, that's a hint. You know, you need to listen to older people because they know what's going on. Yeah. But he listened to the younger people. And as a result of that, there was a breach. And the northern kingdom of Israel became a separate country. But God said to Rehoboam, don't try to do anything about this. This breach is of God. So you had side by side two kingdoms, both representing Israel and Judah specifically. And then we know that the northern kingdom of Israel eventually went into captivity and disappeared into history, became completely paganized. They didn't want to be exceptional. They wanted to be like all the other nations. And that ultimately meant not only having a king rather than God, it meant going full-blown into the same paganism that everybody else was involved with. Be just like all the others. So they disappeared into history. But God knew where they were and would use them in his own time. So you get back to this idea then, America and its founding. The American people viewed themselves, for the most part, certainly the founders, the ones that would become founders in this country, they understood that they were Brits. They were British citizens. But the leadership in Britain, from the king and his court and the parliament, the generals of his army, did not believe that they were British citizens. They were called colonists. And they would be administered from London and forget taxation with representation, because that's just not going to happen. You're not going to be represented. So at some point, the founders, as Ben Franklin did, said, I tear up my relationship with Britain, and I am an American. They became patriots. They began to look around. Since they were rejecting the English king, they looked to God as the highest authority. And they based what they would do in terms of the Constitution on what God has done. And if we need to understand and want to understand history in its true context, we need to know what God has wrought, what God has done, to see God's prophetic hand. And that's kind of what we're about today in this message here. So here we are. The founders, as Franklin said, will either hang together or we will hang separately. So they had to work together, and they did. They put up their fortunes, they risked their lives for this effort to make America free, and they based it all on liberty. Where was that ever done in history? Now, you had a time when the Greeks, for a while, had a little bit of a democracy. That didn't work. The Roman government tried it briefly. It didn't work. But other than that, I mean, and Ben Franklin, years later, came out of the Constitutional Convention, and a woman in Philadelphia said, "Well, Dr. Franklin, what manner of government do we have?" And he said, "Madam, you have a republic, if you can keep it. A republic, if you can keep it." So we, the people, would form a more perfect union. When has that ever happened in world history? And what's that based on? Again, Bible, the Holy Bible. One of the things that God needed to have done, and it was done. The Bible was translated into English in 1611. And so for nearly 200 years, the British and American, or what would be the American people, all of the English-speaking world, they could read the Bible in the English language. What a tremendous influence that was for nearly 200 years. That helped make them ready. They had been paganized, and then they had been overseen by the Romanists for a long time. Now they can read the Bible in their own language. That meant such a lot. That was so important. So the founders looked to God. Well, you can find a reference, first of all, to all men are created equal. It's in the Declaration of Independence. Where did that come from? The idea that rights were inalienable, that they were God-given. See, in enumerating the Bill of Rights, the founders didn't imagine that they were granting anybody any rights. They were just making clear that God is the author of our rights. And they were just enumerating a number of them. Well, when the pilgrims washed up on these shores, they came here for freedom, religious freedom and tolerance. And that became a part of the Declaration of Independence, and especially the Constitution. Now, when was that ever? Freedom of religion, when was that ever really practiced in the world? Now, I think Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, in their lifetimes, had freedom of movement. They weren't really in big cities for the most part. And so they were traders along the caravan routes, and they did very well for themselves, and they could understand what freedom was. But you look at most of history, and it's been one tyranny after the other, one dictatorship after another, one empire after another. When has a free people ever been given liberty? But from God's point of view, if I'm going to bless Ephraim and Manasseh, they need to be free. They need to experience liberty. They need to have the rights that are God-given. So you look at some of these rights: freedom of religion, freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, freedom of the press. What other nation guarantees these? Even the right to bear arms. I mean, what other nation has that? A dictatorship, the first thing they'll do is round up the guns. Property rights. There aren't very many countries that really have honored them in history. So these things are constitutional protections. And then we had checks and balances on our three branches of government so that they would never infringe on the rights of Americans. And of course, nowadays, we've had our Second Amendment under siege. We've had our Tenth Amendment basically ignored. That's the one about states' rights. And so, but America has been exceptional from the beginning. All men are created equal. Now, they knew that there was a problem with slavery, but things were so, they were so difficult and so close at the time of the signing of the Declaration and later of the Constitutional Convention, to have all 13 colonies on board. They couldn't resolve some of these problems then. It had to be put off. There just wasn't any other choice. So let's look at just George Washington just for a moment here. Here was a man that led the American forces in a very hard-fought war. A lot of blood spilled on both sides. And God allowed it, even though it was his will that there be a separation. And God did give America the victory, even though Britain far exceeded them in terms of the military power at that time. But he prayed on his knees at Valley Forge in the snow. It was a very harsh winter, and he prayed for God's intervention and mercy. And then later he became a two-term president. He won the presidency by acclamation. He got every single electoral vote. And then after two terms, he left office, and the world was stunned. The first time in history that anyone had ever walked away from power of their own. They weren't chased out. They weren't murdered. There wasn't any intrigue. There was a peaceful transition from one government to another, one party perhaps over another. When did any of this ever happen? That's what American exceptionalism is. America is one of a kind in this world. One of a kind. Now, why? I want to make one point before we get to the why. There was another man, John Adams, our second president, and he made this observation. He said that the Constitution of this country, of this republic, was meant for a righteous people and would not long endure an unrighteous citizenry. So that's something to chew on and consider, I think, in this message here. But let's now, we've explored American exceptionalism to some extent. Let's then get into the Bible. And the first or the next thought that I want to look at is the fact that God called Israel to be exceptional. Now, I want to begin, I'm already turned there, just reading one verse in Amos chapter 3. Because you ask the question, why? Why America and Britain? It isn't fair, is it? So we read here, God says to the children of Israel, verse 1, and verse 2, you only have I known of all the families of the earth. I've only known, now God reigns his reign on the just and the unjust. He provides food and nourishment for the people of this earth. We can say in any country that will acknowledge God, that yes, God has blessed me. But that's different from saying that God has actually worked with a nation. There's only been one nation or people in Earth's history that he has worked through and with. Unless you think that that's a cakewalk, look at the rest of the verse. It says, therefore I will punish you for all your iniquities. God gave so much to Israel, both materially and spiritually, and when they went awry and when they went astray, when they rebelled against him, he had no choice but to discipline. That's certainly true. Now, let's go and answer our question as to why. Let's look at Genesis 15. And again, those that have read our new booklet are very familiar with this. In fact, we've looked at this over the years in the church many times. Look at Genesis 15. I'm only glossing through some of this just to give us the high points of this, just so we can answer our question and stay on topic about exceptionalism here. But look at Genesis 15. Look at verse 3. Genesis 15, then Abraham said, look, you have given me no offspring. Indeed, one born in my house is my heir. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, this one shall not be your heir, but one who comes from your own body. Isaac would be the son of promise. And Ishmael certainly was not the son of faith. He was the son kind of made by human nature. But Isaac was the son of faith. Then he brought him outside and said, look now toward heaven and count the stars if you're able to number them. And he said, so shall your descendants be. And it says that he believed God and he accounted it to him for righteousness. So let's turn over to Genesis 22 and read part of this account. This is a very familiar account of actually being told to offer up his precious and beloved son Isaac. And I'm just going to break into this in verse 12, of the angel of the Lord speaking on God's behalf. Verse 12, and he said, "Do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." Then Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, there was a ram, and the ram would be given instead. Look at verse 15 then. Then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time out of heaven and said, "By myself I have sworn, says the Lord, because you have done this thing and not withheld your son, your only son, in blessing I will bless you, and in multiplying I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your descendants shall possess the gates of their enemies." Now that is a statement of something called the birthright in the Bible. And notice, too, when it talks about the gates of one's enemies, it's talking about sea gates. So there's an implication, then, that along with this blessing would come naval power and military might. That's just a hint of a suggestion there, in possessing the gates of your enemies. So in verse 18, then, we have something called the scepter. That is, salvation through Christ is offered, again, as a part of the Abrahamic covenant. Verse 18, "In your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." Well, then I want to turn over to a couple pages to Genesis 26, where God is speaking to Isaac and reconfirming these things in Isaac. Look at verse 3 of Genesis 26. He says, "Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and your descendants I will give these lands, and I will perform the oath which I swore to your father Abraham." God always keeps his word, even through the many generations, as we'll soon read. Verse 4, "And I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of heaven, and I will give your descendants all these lands, and in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed." Again, both halves of the Abrahamic covenant. Why? Verse 5, "Because Abraham obeyed my voice, kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my law." Abraham was God's friend. He had a special relationship with Abraham, and then with the fathers, Isaac and Jacob. And he kept things going in that line through the 12 sons of Jacob. So that gives us the answer to why, but we're still developing this other thought that God called Israel to be exceptional. So let's look at Exodus 19, when God had delivered them from Egyptian slavery. Exodus 19, start in verse 5 here. We'll read about this covenant, the old covenant that God would make with them. Verse 5, "Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all the people, for all the earth is mine." See, it's God's plan and God's purpose, and he works things out the way that he will work things out. He doesn't always think at the same level in the same way that we do. He thinks far higher plane of thought than we do. "And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel." So it says, so Moses came and called for the elders and laid before them all these words that the Lord commanded him. Then all the people answered and said, "All that the Lord has said, we will do." So there was a covenant which was likened into a marriage covenant on one level, but on another level was just God being their king. God was their king, God was their ruler, and God's wonderful law were the precepts that they lived by. They were exceptional in every sense of the word. And God wanted them to be an example for all other nations. So let's see that by turning to Deuteronomy 4 and continue this. We're still filling in some of the information here on the fact that Israel was called to be exceptional. To Deuteronomy chapter 4. And we'll look at verse 5 once I get there. And verse 5, here's Moses. "Surely I have taught you statutes and judgments, just as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should act according to them in the land which you shall go to possess. Therefore, be careful to observe them." So this is what they had to do. It wasn't enough just to possess the land. There were certain considerations, certain responsibilities that they had. "For this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples, who will say when they hear of all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. So that was God's intent that they fulfill that. For what great nation is there that has God so near it as the Lord our God is to us, for whatever reason we may call upon him? And what great nation is there that has such statutes and righteous judgments as are in all this law, which I set before you this day? This is still Moses talking. Only take heed to yourself and diligently keep yourself, lest you forget the things that your eyes have seen, and lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life, and teach them to your children and grandchildren. Now, one more passage along this line, and over a couple pages to Deuteronomy 7, and it'll fill in even a little more information. Deuteronomy 7, starting in verse 6, "For you are a holy people to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for himself, a special treasure above all the peoples of the earth. The Lord did not set his love on you, nor choose you because you were more in number than any other people. For you are the least of all peoples. But because the Lord loves you, and because he would keep the oath," notice again, "he would keep the oath which he swore to your fathers. The Lord has brought you out with a mighty hand, and redeem you from the house of bondage, from the hand of the Pharaoh, king of Egypt." Now, verse 9, "Therefore know that the Lord your God, he is God, the faithful God who keeps covenant and mercy for 1,000 generations." I don't think we've had 1,000 generations since that time. Maybe not, but I don't think so. "But he'll keep covenant and mercy for 1,000 generations with those who love him and keep his commandments." So that's the responsibility that the Israelites had. But they were called to be exceptional, and that was God's expectation. Now, develop another thought, that Joseph was also called to be exceptional. Remember the patriarch Joseph, someone who was the 11th son. He was sold to the Egyptians ultimately because his brothers were jealous of him. But he got there, and he had hardships, and he ended up in a prison cell. But God exalted him in due course, and he became second in command in all of Egypt. And he was there to save his own family members, all 70 of them, from famine. And he was there to save the land of Egypt at such a time as that. So he was an exceptional man to be the prototype for the house of Joseph. Let's look at back to Genesis again, this time 48. This is, again, covered pretty thoroughly in our booklet, and it's a very moving section of scripture here. And there's a little irony here too, remembering that Jacob had played some tricks on Esau to get this birthright, but at the very least, Jacob understood the value of the birthright, and Esau didn't. So here we are years later, and we see Jacob, his name changed to Israel, in verse 11, "And Israel said to Joseph, I had not thought to see your face, but in fact, God has also shown me your offspring." So he was presented with his own grandchildren. It must have been very moving. So verse 11, and Joseph took them both, Ephraim with his right hand and toward Israel's left hand, and Manasseh with his left hand toward Israel's right hand, and brought them near to him for a blessing. Then Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, guiding his hands knowingly. So this was done under divine inspiration, for Manasseh was the firstborn. And he blessed Joseph, saying, "God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has fed me all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. Let my name be named upon them." And the name of Israel has been on them from that time forward. And the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac. So he was taking his grandchildren and adopting them, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. So that's a blessing for Joseph. And then Joseph was concerned that Ephraim was being exalted before the firstborn. Nothing new there, but verse 19, his father said, I know, my son. He also shall be great. And to this day, America is called the greatest nation in the world. It's frequent that we hear that. But truly, his younger brother shall be greater. Great Britain, again, has the word great right in its name. And he shall, his descendants shall become a multitude of nations. Now, what we consider Ephraim prophetically, Britain is the only nation that has grown and multiplied the way that it has. Britain is the only nation that we can say is a multitude of nations, because at the core, Britain obviously is British at the core. Australia is British at the core. So is New Zealand, and so is Canada, generally. And of course, there are lots of Ephraimites in this country. Even now, I have a feeling, probably mostly in the southern part of the country, is my guess. But why? How'd that happen? Well, we'll look at that as we move along here. But again, it just helps us identify Britain as Ephraim, the only nation that has had, because other nations, they would conquer and they would have various fiefdoms within their overall nation or their empire, but that's not what happened here. Even though Britain had an empire and they had control over one quarter of the Earth's resources at one time, but at some point they didn't have an empire, but they're still a multitude of nations. Verse 20, so he blessed them that day, saying, by you Israel will bless, saying, may God make you as Ephraim and as Manasseh. And thus he set Ephraim before Manasseh. Now let's look at chapter 49, where we'll actually look at Joseph's blessings. But just notice in verse 1 that these blessings are for the last days. Why would God do that? Why didn't he instantly fulfill this? Now, I have an idea on that, and I think we can demonstrate it. But we'll just ask that question. Now, the other thing is, how do we measure the last days? When would that be? When did that start? Now, in our literature, especially on the 10 tribes, we have often linked it with the 1803, which was the Louisiana Purchase, the greatest inheritance, the greatest purchase, so to speak, $50 million. How many acres of land did that buy for each cent? An incredible, it just multiplied America. And we were only into our third presidency of Jefferson. Just the third president. And an incredible inheritance came. Yes, it was purchased from the French. Old Reuben came to the rescue and sold an incredibly valuable piece of property, which doubled and trebled and quadrupled the size of the United States and made it almost immediately a world power. Just based on that. That was 1803. Now, from the Bible, you look at Daniel 12, verse 4. We won't turn there, but you might write that down. It's very familiar. In the time of the end, many would go to and fro, and knowledge would be increased. So, when did that first start happening? 1805, James Watt, the Scotsman, invented the steam engine. Let's think about the steam engine for a minute now. It wasn't long before they had a larger version of it on ships. And then you could take something the size of the Mayflower and greatly expand it. Powerful engines, powerful cargo space, much room for passengers. You could take it over the pond, as we say, very rapidly compared to old methods of sailing ships. That was a tremendous advancement, and that happened in 1805. And it wasn't long before that same steam engine was put on wheels and rails and became trains that fully engulfed both Britain and America. I guess it was somewhere around 1855 or maybe 1860, somewhere in there when we completed the East and West, and we finally connected up all of our rail lines. But Lincoln took a train to Washington, and his body came back on a train. So in the 19th century, a lot of things were changing, and a lot of technology was coming along. Again, part of the birthright, technology that was developed either in Britain with British know-how or Yankee ingenuity, one way or another. But we began to be very powerfully blessed beginning about 1803 or 1805. So that's what we're saying is the last days. Now let's go over to verse 22, which talks about Joseph. Joseph would be a fruitful bough. That means he would be very populous. He would become very rich in children. A fruitful bough by a well. He would be near water and would obviously be very well acquainted with that water. Again, the implication, he would have a navy being on water. And not only that, but we see in the next phrase, his branches run over the wall, we see that he would project his power around the world. He would project the power. The way you come up against enemies that want to attack you is that you're confronting them as you begin exercising your power. And Britain very soon became the masters of the oceans. It didn't take long. And it wasn't all that they were just trying to build an empire or anything. Some of that empire just fell into their lap. They would sail into an island, and before they knew it, it was a part of Britain. Sometimes they had to fire a shot or two, but that is not what you'd call a full-scale invasion by any means. But they did grow an empire, for sure. And it says, the archers have bitterly grieved him and shot at him and hated him. So as America and Britain have grown and maintained power, first Britain, and they eradicated slavery from the high seas in about the middle of the 19th century, even before the American Civil War, which did the same thing here with the Emancipation Proclamation. So it says, verse 24, but his bow remained in strength. Look at all the, beginning with Napoleon forward, look at all the tyranny that America and Britain, Britain almost, with a coalition, but they defeated Napoleon. And then with American help, they took on the Kaiser, they took on Hitler, they took on all the wannabes that came along, every dictatorship that ever came along since then. And Britain in World War II, they handed off the military power, the Pax Britannica, the peace and security and order that they had maintained on the high seas for over 100 years. They turned that over to America. And America's been fulfilling that same role ever since. And not only did we have a navy to project ourselves and bring peace and relative security, yes, there were proxy wars, but there has been peace and security. And it's benefited the church and the work that the church is doing in modern times. And we'll talk more about that in due course here. But his bow remained in strength. And we look at in our booklet, we highlight the miracle at Dunkirk as an example of how God helped Britain and how God helped America win its wars and fight off the tyrants. And now in recent days, when America has wanted to shelve its responsibilities, and we talk about leading from behind and kind of disappearing from the world stage, that's when we're starting to see tyranny after tyranny step forward. That's when we see Russia want to take possessions. That's when we see China want to take possessions. That's when we see Al-Qaeda and ISIS advancing. So, God gave us responsibilities. And part of that was to maintain a certain order in the world. You know, whether we liked it or not, we were a kind of policeman to the world. And after World War II, America had respect. People wanted to come here. They respected this country. We were the only power, the superpower in the world. We had a nuclear shield to protect our allies. And even to this day, the nuclear shield of the United States protects Europe and many of our allies overseas. So we're still doing good in the world. I mean, if there's a flood somewhere, if there's a tsunami somewhere, if there's an earthquake somewhere, it's America that's standing right there to help. We've done that, and so in some ways we've used the resources God has given us in a right way. And God wanted us to set a good example, not just to have material blessings that we could bask in, but we'd have responsibilities with that. So we'd have to be exceptional to represent God rightly. And we did that for a while and for a time. But now, again, we're coming to a crossroads, and we have to make a decision. What way are we going to go as a nation in the future? And I guess the jury's still out, although we know ultimately that a time of Jacob's trouble will come, and it gives us the indication that we may continue to slide downward. But now we're good, verse 24. But his bow remained in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. So by the God of your father who will help you, and by the Almighty who will bless you. And now here come the blessings, the material things that we've had. The blessings of heaven above, that we'd have rain in due season, great agriculture. The blessings of the deep that lies beneath. We'd have minerals, we'd have oil. The blessings of the breast and the womb. Again, a very large and largely healthy population. The blessings of your father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. These shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him who was separate from his brothers. So we saw this long battle in the book of Genesis. Who would have the birthright? Would it be Ishmael? Would it be Esau? Would it be some of the other brothers? Finally, it was Joseph. And now we see at the end of the book that here is the prophecy. And now we've lived long enough to see the fulfillment of that prophecy. So what we're looking at today, we're looking at historical examples of God's prophetic hand. fulfill prophecy, and that should encourage us. But God will keep all of his promises that he has made to us. God, there will be salvation through Christ. There will be forgiveness of sins. There will be a kingdom of God. So Joseph was to be exceptional, but right now we seem to be walking away to some extent from that. Now, there's one other thought I need to develop as we begin to wrap this up. The next thought is that the church that Jesus Christ built was also to be exceptional, because not just because it was founded by God and his Son, but because it was founded on better promises and it was founded on the precepts and the law of God. Look at 1 Peter. It'll be our only passage that we use to show this. But keep in mind, though, that the church has a gospel message to bring. We find both in Matthew 24, a prophecy about how the kingdom would be preached to all the nations of the world before the end would come. And then we see Matthew 28, which is the actual commission, about verse 18. So now I want to read 1 Peter, which shows us that we are exceptional. 1 Peter 2, starting in verse 4. Verse 4 here, coming to him, that is Christ, as to a living stone, rejected indeed by men, but chosen by God and precious. You also, as living stones, are being built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. And then verse 9, but you are a chosen generation and a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his holy people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness and into his marvelous light, who once were not a people, but now are the people of God, who have obtained mercy when they had not originally, but now they have obtained mercy. So that's what we've been called to, sonship in God's kingdom, to be the children of God now. But we haven't only been called for our own salvation. We've been called to preach the gospel to the world, as we just said. So that brings us to the point. Can't we say that Joseph's birthright and the scepter promise have coincided in the end time, in the last days? Because the church has the message of the scepter, salvation through Christ and the coming governance of Christ for 1,000 years and the saints ruling with him. That's the church's responsibility, to take that message to the world, and to do it in any other age would be unthinkable. But to do it with the American nuclear shield and the peace and safety that the American Navy has given us over time, America's power has given us, to use America's resources and British resources to get this work done. And those two nations, America and Britain, have contributed more to the work of the church than any other nations in the world. That's by design, brethren. That's the way of God. That's the purpose of God. That's why Joseph, I know there are other explanations about how we can count certain numbers of years and certain numbers of curses and penalties that were on Israel, and that's true too. But this is a reason in its own right why God waited till the last days to give Joseph his blessings. So we need to contemplate the lessons of this and remember what God has given us as a responsibility. Now I want to close where we started in the book of Amos. One or two more passages from the book of Amos, this time Amos chapter 5, which has some things to say specifically to Joseph, things that are useful to us now and very meaningful. I just have to, where was I? Amos, you're here somewhere. Should have put a marker on this. There we are, Amos, looking for chapter 5, and I'll start in verse 6. Amos 5, verse 6, seek the Lord and live, lest he break out like a fire in the house of Joseph and devour it, with no one to quench it in Bethel. You who turn justice to wormwood and lay righteousness to rest in the earth. Now, when you look at this prophecy, it begins talking about the day of the Lord. So I think we can say that this is a prophecy for the end time. Let's look at verse 12 here. For I know your manifold transgressions. That applies to now for sure. I haven't gone into the sins of this country, but I think if I were to ask each one of you, you could each come up with something that we have degenerated in and gone down in. So, but your sins are mighty before God. You afflict the just and take bribes. You divert the poor from justice at the gate. Therefore, the prudent weep in silence at such a time, for it is an evil time. Seek good, that's the answer. Seek good and not evil, that you may live. That could be a message that we give to our nations now. So the Lord God of hosts will be with you as you have spoken. Hate evil, love good, establish justice in the gate. It may be that the Lord God of hosts will be gracious to the remnant of Joseph. So brethren, we've looked at American exceptionalism and seen the examples from the Bible of how the people of God have always needed to be exceptional to fulfill what God had in mind for them. So it may take some repentance further, and it may even take a time of Jacob's trouble, but the time will come when the house of Israel will be planted securely in the millennium and will finally be that example nation that God always intended them to be. So it's just something to think about at this Thanksgiving season.